Marcus? Hi, how are you?
Not bad. Yourself?
Doing just fine.
I saw you in New York, didn't I?
Yeah.
That's right.
I gave the talk about bees there.
I remember it very well.
So, yeah, well, I remember the symphony very well. It was it was really quite something, so...
It was interesting.
Well, I'm just really glad to be able to see it again, and pretty soon in September.
Indeed.
So, I was thinking we could just jump right into recording the conversation because, you know, a lot of the best interview bits kind of come out of just sort of regular conversation.
Can I just, let me just tell them to not come in.
Yeah, sure, do that.
There are two small children who sometimes they'll jump in, so they've been restrained.
Sure, I understand. And sometimes telling them not to come in is probably a surefire method of getting them to come into the room.
It's interesting.
Well, that's great. So this interview is particular for promoting the September 15th show, part of the Touch 30 Festival. It's going to be held here in New York from the 13th to the 16th, primarily at Issue Project Room. And on the 15th, you're going to be performing the Bee Symphony again. For the third time, is that correct? Or
fourth. We've recently just done it at the Bergen International Festival in the Bergen Cathedral.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was only a couple of weeks ago, so that was a very fine event. It was a perfect venue for the Bee Symphony in a nice cathedral, fantastic acoustic. And it was a very classy event. We had excellent singers, and it was very well received, so everyone's very pleased, basically.
I bet that was a beautiful place to do the symphony. Just gorgeous.
It was totally awesome. It was an old, ancient stone cathedral, and it had a very reasonably large. But the acoustic was just—you could hear a pin drop from the back. So it just lent itself very well to an occasion where you needed to hear specific things. It lent itself very well to a piece which had a lot to it orally, so you had to hear stuff, basically, if that makes any sense.
The minutiae of sound. And, you know, it's also interesting because from a historical perspective, because monks were some of the original beekeepers, so that they sort of devised a lot of the methodology that we use very much today for beekeeping.
So
it kind of makes sense historically, too, that, you know, in
it does.
A cathedral environment, the symphony. But on the 15th, you're going to be doing two pieces, is that correct? Symphony and then a piece that's still untitled. It's a new piece.
Yes, people keep on asking us to come up with a title.
Yeah, people want a name, don't they?
People do, actually, and I would really like to give one. But it's so still in its developmental stage. We know what it's going to sound like, but we won't have a sense that the name will appear of its own volition at the right time. And so we're just kind of sitting on it and letting it happen. I know it's for programming people, that's probably quite annoying, but there's a very much of a sense of a thing evolving at the moment, so we don't really want to put a title which won't be appropriate at the end.
Yeah, the name will come out of after performing it a few times. That makes sense.
Well, hopefully before the actual first concert. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed the track that you sent me of some of the raw material for the concert. It was a song of a gray seal. It was really, it was actually struck me as being very funny.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
That and that the seal voice was strikingly similar to a human voice, you know, that when it was talking, except maybe a human that was a little bit, had too much to drink, or was a little bit of a fool or something.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't be able to relate to that, of course.
No, who would? So with the Bee Symphony, you come into a place and you work with a number of people as a chorus to sing along with the bees, or communicate in a way with the sounds of the bees.
Yeah.
Is it going to be the same for the new piece?
Essentially, yes. What I found working with the bee sounds is that it's actually something which is now influencing everything I do now, because what absolutely astounded me about the bees was how musical they were. Number one, all the notes they sing are easily in the human range, which is surprising for such a small animal. But the other thing was I was really quite shocked how musical they were, so it was quite easy to notate what they sang. So as their mood changed, the chord would change, and they'd sing these little tunes, and B time is a bit longer than ours in kind of a change. And so I actually literally notated what they sang in real time, and then got humans to sing it, and it sounds strikingly effective. And to me, it almost sounded like Aboriginal music. So I was absolutely astounded. And also the bees sang perfectly in tune the whole time, in tune to an A, just below the A we 440. And they didn't deviate from that note at all. They were perfectly in tune, and that note, bass note, only changed when they were asleep, and it dropped by about a semitone. So, I mean, I was completely shocked how absolutely musical it all was, basically. And so I lifted all these notes and arranged it myself, so every note that you hear in the B symphony is a note sung by a bee. And so I felt that literally humans were singing with bees. So I'll be doing the same thing with the C sounds. Again, I'm starting to go through them. And when you listen, it's very, very musical. And it's now my ears are attuned to it. I can hear the notes. And I'm just basically notating the music in these sounds. And so I'm drawing the music in these sounds. So therefore, when the humans sing it, they are hopefully literally singing with this sound from nature. And it's kind of led me on a little exploratory journey, really. And one of the things I'm really interested in is the sounds from space. And of course, I've been doing that, but loads of recording of satellites and planets and the Earth and just kind of everything. And again, notes the whole time. As some of the planets are so tuneful, it's shocking. So, I mean, the thing I've been discovering is that everywhere I've been looking in nature, it's musical.
Were you always interested in nature? Did you, as a young boy, were you the kind of person that would sit outside and or look in the grass or turn over logs, or was it something that sort of came to you through the music itself, through the composition, that you started becoming more and more in tune with the natural environment?
I suppose I was reasonably. I was I grew up in Worcester, reasonably kind of countryside-ish where we were and everything. So I mean, didn't exactly grow up in a kind of a alienated urban environment or anything, but I must say that this thing has suddenly tuned me into something which I was latently lurking within myself. I'd always been kind of interested about, you know, holistic things and vibrations, and you know, I mean, just by looking at this, I found out so many ways where human beings are literally tuned to the planet. I don't know if they know about the Schoenberg resonances. If you imagine from the surface of the Earth to the edge of the atmosphere, it's like a sound box. It's like almost like an organ pipe. And each pipe, for example, a flute, all has its own resonant frequencies, if you just blow. And so does the Earth's atmosphere. And one of the things I found out was that the first resonant frequency of the human resonances is 7.8 hertz, and that's the alpha wave frequency of our brains. I was reading this, I just thought, I can't believe this. So we are literally in tune with the planet, basically. And so
that's amazing.
Oh no, I've just been on this crazy journey as a result, and my mind is, I'm just completely shocked every time I am. I'm finding more and more that music is absolutely inherent in nature. And another thing I found which blew me away, I was reading about Pythagoras, and as you know, he gave us allegedly our scale with the 13 semitones. And I was reading about him, and to cut a very long story short, he says he found that you've got a string, you divide it in half, that's an octave. If you divide it in three, that's a perfect fifth. If you divide it in four, that's a fourth, whatever. And these are the frequencies which our human ear finds most attractive, and they found these intervals attractive before we knew these were perfect mathematical fraction. So Pythagoras said that human beings are predisposed to be tuned to the universe, as it were, to the perfect ratios. And I just found that concept also absolutely amazing. The fact is, you know, perhaps we are literally, because we find these intervals so fascinating, perhaps we are literally tuned to the universe, as Pythagoras said. So I just sent me on this like kind of a journey of investigation. So I'm butchering on. Shut up.
No, I mean, it is amazing. It's the controlling mathematics too that's behind the shape of the seashells and the way that trees differentiate or plants differentiate when they grow. And
as humans, we like these perfect ratios best.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, we are part of nature. As much as we've tried to separate ourselves from it.
Oh, absolutely.
Perhaps, you know, hanging out in our urban environments, we are, you know, forget about or have lost sort of a touch with biodiversity.
Oh, I think so. And like I said, when I listen to the bees, I got humans to sing it. Humans.
Homo sapiens have singing with the bees now.
As apart from whatever.
Aliens.
Exactly. I just thought, to me, it sounded strangely like Aboriginal music. It's like, you know, I mean, perhaps this is where the Aboriginals got their sense of music from listening to nature. And, you know, the bees sing notes, and why not?
Why not? That seems like a very reasonable hypothesis. Just listening outside at night. I grew up in the country too, and you listen to the whirling sounds of cicadas, along with the field crickets, along with this, and along with the frogs singing, and there's an order to all of that. You know, some of it is just a sort of a sexual selection order. One song for it, one frog sings, and then another frog responds, and it's sort of this call and response thing. But the whole ecosystem is singing. And it does create sort of an orchestral sound.
And I've very much felt that it was also communication. I had a sense that, certainly after listening to hours of bees, that they communicated also very strongly through sound. And one of the things which put me onto this was that when we were doing the recording, I was standing well back, photographing, and Mike was sticking microphones.
I've seen the pictures, it's pretty hilarious.
But just before on the recording, before he was stung, the whole beehive sound changed. And from kind of a diaphanous beeing sound, they all sang very strongly this one A. Perfect pitch on its own. They all hear that very strongly through the sound. So I don't know if the decision is made via and then portrayed by the sound, or the sound helps to galvanize everyone to make the decision. I don't know how it works, but it's definitely a big element to what's happening, basically.
Well, here's an interesting thing. So honeybees, or the honey-producing bees, which Apis mellifera is one of them, their biggest pests or their biggest threats in this world are mammals. So if you imagine who's after honey, it's, you know, bears are after honey, people are after honey. There's other mammals that are after honey. And evolutionarily speaking, they've always been. It's like it's always been the mammals that have been the biggest devastators to bees. It kind of makes sense then that bees would give a threat signal to their potential, you know, threat in a tune or that they would know, you know, in a way that the human would understand, because the human is one of the biggest predators of wild bees.
I must say, when this all kicked off and the bees went on to the attack, I was standing well back and some of the bees had come out of the hive and passed me. And I was aware of this tiny thing emitting incredible anger. And I wanted to get out, just one of them going past. It was so anger. The energy of this thing was just extraordinary. Yeah. I'll never forget that.
You had an innate fear,
You could feel how angry this thing was. It was amazing. You know, when they were really, really angry. And the beekeeper said she'd never known the bees this angry before.
So that's the other thing that strikes me about the two pieces, they're both about communication with nature, and sort of this, not just a one-way communication necessarily, but it's almost like it's a two-way communication.
Yeah.
But the Bee Symphony is dealing with one species. So yeah. It's a journey, of a very intimate journey with one organism, one species, and getting to know that species in a sense really, really well. Where the other piece is, it's more of a journey of biodiversity along a pathway, like along a climate change.
Yeah.
From, you know, where there's areas of very rich biodiversity and sort of a warmer climate in Norway, all the way to some of the most, you know, extreme regions of the world where the biodiversity, at least the macro biodiversity, drops heavily. And but it's another way of, like, viewing sort of the richness of nature.
Oh, certainly.
When you were choosing how did you choose the recordings that you did of the animals as you moved along? How did that happen? Did you take a boat trip, or did you go to specific locations along the way, or?
Well, these are all recordings that Chris Watson has made, and so it's when we were talking about the next piece, he was thinking about various recordings he's made over the years in various. Different places, and I suppose the idea of the journey came out as a way to utilize some of these different recordings, and I've been slowly listening to them, and they're stunning in their variety. So this piece will be a different sound collage completely, and we're quite taken with the journey thing, and it's almost like a sound map.
Mm-hmm.
Of a particular part of the world, so that's kind of the area we're going in. We're still analysing the different tracks to find their musicality, and we have a kind of an outline, and so the musicality and the sounds of the tracks will eventually form our piece. So it's this is why it was hard to give you an overall sound file, because it's still evolving in its shape at the moment.
Right.
And it's. I think not only is it a journey, it's taken us on a journey, and we actually don't know where it's going to lead to.
Right. Like what part of the world it's going to lead to.
Well, we do, yeah. But as a piece of music, it's going to take us somewhere different, like the Bee Symphony did, actually. So it's quite an exciting journey. It's definitely a jump over the cliff. And we'll end up somewhere, but we know what we want. We know it's a journey, it's a specific shape, but that will also take you to another place as well. So it's quite exciting, really.
Yeah.
And like I said, the diversity of Chris's recordings, and the quality's stunning. And I mean, we've got ice, kelp.
Help.
You know, yeah, seashore. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary, the diversity of these recordings. So it's like I said, this is going to evolve from its own nature.
So is kelp the first plant that you've ever sung with?
It may well be, actually. Whether or not it gets into the final mix, I don't know, but it's part of the sound good. Yeah, absolutely.
But there's all these recordings, I guess in the 70s, it's like songs to help your plants grow. Songs to make your plants feel better.
Yeah, exactly. Songs to make friends with seals, in this sense.
Exactly. Yeah, I was imagining, you know, listening to the seal recordings and thinking that this piece may be a sort of comedic in some parts, because the...
Well, it. I was thinking that as well, bizarrely, when I was teaching the Bee Symphony, every time actually, especially this time when I was in Bergen, when I teach the vocal parts and I'm trying to impress on the singers that this is actually the notes that the bees sing, and there's some very specific bee sounds in it, basically. There's and I've literally copied some of the sounds that bees make, and there's one sound that goes like that. The bees make the sound a lot in their lives. And so I notated it musically and everything, and they have to sing this and communicate with each other. And when they first started trying it, they were literally on the floor crying with laughter, basically. I saw that as a good sign, because I saw they were really getting into it.
Yeah.
But it is a shock to do it the first time, and
yeah, maybe a certain amount of joy in it too.
Oh, I think so. I mean, once they got out of the way, that out of the way, and they got into the communication aspects. That's the thing. To me, that's the thing that have brought it alive. Is the fact, like the bees, the singers are communicating with each other, and that gives it that extra sparkle, as it were. And I'm sure I'll be using that again for this CP. Now I've learned these things, how to integrate nature and music.
So the singers themselves sort of became part of their own little hive.
They did, exactly. This is what when I had realized this is the way to go, it's worked every time, basically. So it brings a bit of a theater, and it kind of brings it alive, basically. So not only are the human, like you say, the humans have their own hive, but the bees are communicating. So I hope that basically you get the feeling that the bees and the humans are literally communicating with each other. And I will be trying to recreate that again in our Sea Symphony, as it were, for want of a better title.
Yeah, it seems, you know, bees are very familiar to people. You know, even here in New York, that we have honeybees and we see honeybees. I think it seems to me that the challenge very much with the other piece is going to be bringing people in touch with organisms that they may never see or they have impressions of, perhaps, but only from television shows, but they don't have any very personal memories with, where most people can have a personal memory or personal experience with bees or honey or, you know, products of bees.
So therefore, hopefully everyone will join in with our feeling of this is actually a journey, an oral journey. Like I said, a journey, sound map, however you want to call it, and that's going to differentiate this one particularly from the bees, which is, like I said, it's just one environment and one species. So it's a departure, literally and metaphorically.
right. But, you know, it also could be a reminder in some ways that, you know, the tonal notes of the seal and how almost human voiced it is already in the other.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But it's a reminder that we are actually all part of the same, you know, organism, Earth.
Absolutely, yeah. We're all codependent on each other, and we all need the Earth to survive. And so, I mean, I think also what is very interesting to me at the moment is that this will also be a journey from the shore and then underwater as well. So it's both sides of the surface. And so that's I find that particularly interesting. And I use some electronic effects on a Bee Symphony, and I hopefully use some as well on this to kind of create that sound aura as well. So I mean, there's actually almost too much material, really. So it's going to be going to have to be smart to balance it all out.
Or maybe more than one piece.
Yes, exactly.
So the other thing I was from your very short description that you sent me about the journey, that the journey is going from a place that is, you know, very loud in many ways, the warmer parts of the world, where there's a lot of diversity, to a place that's fairly silent. Or one of the more, at least industrial, silent parts of the world, and where there's less air traffic, there's less. I mean, just trying to set up my apartment for this interview and try to cut out the street noises, the car sirens, the alarms, the guy working downstairs.
Yeah.
You know, all of this sort of ambient industrial noise all the time. Do you find when composing for or listening to the silence or the silent areas that you keep finding more and more songs or sounds in those silent spaces? That
absolutely. This is the thing which, again, has really shocked me. Throughout nature, if you sit down and you listen, it's full of music. There's I live in Norway now, and the family has a cabin, as most a lot of Norwegian families do up in the mountains. And there's a fantastic strong stream just by the cabin, and as a kind of a test for all this, I've sat down and just kind of meditated next to the stream, and within minutes you can hear notes and chords and sound movements and everything. So this is the exciting thing for me. It's never dull, and if you listen to it, you can find the music in it. There's new notes and new shapes for you to start working with. So it's probably an inexhaustible supply of music, inspiration for you, really. And it's, like I said before, it's taking me all over the place at the moment. And it's been a great surprise for me, I must say.
Have you gotten into recording natural sounds yourself?
I've started to a bit, actually, yes. I mean, I'm learning having the right technique and the right instrumentation and gear is actually very important. That's why Chris Watson is so successful in what he does. It's because he knows how to do it properly. And so there's a big difference between having a go and doing it really, really well. I think, one of the things which I've been thrilled is that when you listen to Chris's recordings, they're brilliant. And they're so well recorded and so clear, and actually you can actually feel and visualize the places where these things are recorded, because they seem to be recorded so well. So I mean, I think that's a massive plus point, actually, just the quality of these recordings. And they have their own life. They're so good, you can listen to them on their own if you want, and be fully kind of satisfied by the listening experience. So
I was wanting to ask you a little bit about the process with the people that you use when but collaborate with the because you go travel from town to town and recruit volunteers, more or less, from whatever town you're going to. And so can you explain a little bit more about that process? And has it ever completely failed?
Actually, no, so far. We've usually been put in contact with people who know good local singers, and we explain to them that it's not a usual piece and that they'll need a sense of humour, and it can be quite experimental. But we do need people who can pitch very, very well, who are kind of self-confident and are not afraid to sing out of the box, if that's the right phrase. So far that's worked extremely well, and I've always tried to write music it where it's learnable and performable. I think one of the faults of some modern contemporary classical music, I find, is it's so hard that it's almost impossible to sing as it was intended. So I've always tried to bear in mind specifically the performer and give them something which not only is attainable, but something which is they actually quite like to sing. And if you do that, I think you get a good response from the performer, basically. So that's always been at the back of my mind. I learned that at music college, actually. So I mean, so the process has been okay, and I've got to know different people each time. And even we've had a lot of fun, and I try to keep the rehearsals fun, and it's so far, touch wood, it's worked every single time. So also that has been part of the fun of these projects, as we meet a new set of people each time, and they have to be properly incorporated into the project for it to work. And so we all get to know each other and we're all responding, and so the actual intensity in the performance is really quite high, basically, because you really have to throw yourself into it. And so it's quite a big thing, really.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, you're putting yourself in a very vulnerable situation.
Oh, yes.
You know, I mean, it takes a very brave heart to do it, where you walk into a place, you know, you've maybe had some contact with them before, set amount of time before the actual show happens, you know, and have to find a way to connect. Yeah. Both parties do, and meet in the middle before the show show goes on. And it's an interesting way to work.
I found that you can't be too prescriptive, basically. You've got to let people find their own thing. And sometimes if they say, can we do it like this? I'll often say yes, because if they're kind of almost finding their own performance in it, I quite enjoy that, actually. So I think, because some of the sections are kind of semi-improvised, so if they can find their own character with that, I think that adds a really strong edge, and it means they're being fully involved and enjoying it. So I mean, I find again it's, you're kind of just pushing someone in a direction and seeing what happens. Each performance has been different for its own reasons as a result, and again that's kind of a live feel, like bees are live, they don't fall into a script, and again that gives it a really cool edge as well, I think.
So every bee symphony is slightly different. Absolutely. From the last bee symphony.
It's also different because of the sound of the building, and also due to the how it's mixed as well. You know, I've been lucky where we've had excellent sound people every time, and I mean, for example, in Bergen, they spent a long time changing the timings of the speakers. So when you heard the sound from the, if you were at the back, you heard the sound from the front, it would come at the same time as the speakers in the back and everything. They spent ages doing these tiny, tiny. It was a total geek paradise. It was hilarious. You could see them absolutely loving it.
Those are the people you want helping you do tech for this stuff.
Yeah, because the sound was excellent, you know. And I thought, wow, you know, I know you're geeking out, but I'll let you do that because it's going to be really good. And I found when you put on a thing like this, the difference between good and really good is the last 2 or 3%. I think that's the same, I think, in any kind of realm of performance I've experienced now. It's the tiny, tiny little things you pay attention to, which just push it up to that, those final few percent, which makes it something special. And I think that's what you're always looking for. It's a lot of energy.
It's a lot of energy. Oh, it is.
Crazy.
Huge. So do you usually spend about a week with the singers before the performance, or is it?
6 hours.
6 hours. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's actually, I'm shocked. I'm sitting here in shock. That's mind blowing. Yeah.
But to me, you know, things cost money.
That's true. And time and places, yeah. Moving places and everything.
Yeah.
So have you, I noticed in your biography that you've worked with theater and dance, contemporary dance some as well in your past. Have you thought of sort of doing these symphonic performances with dancers, sort of echoing the sounds of bees or moving it into a more theatrical means and not just vocal?
Well, it's someone has already started talking about that at one point, so and that was without me asking. So I mean, if I think it's very, very I would certainly like to do that, because like I said, a lot of my background is with music, with dance. So I mean, I can see this performed.
I can almost see it, you know. I mean,
exactly.
I can perfect for it.
I can see it as well. I would love for it to be performed as well. We're already thinking for the next C piece to have a visual component as well. So we want to branch it out. And but like you say, I mean, I've actually held back from suggesting dance, but again, if you've got the dance involved, that's another level of production values and basically money.
It's another layer of complexity. That's right.
Yeah, if I'm ever in that situation, that will be one of the first things I suggest.
I was having visualizations of dancers acting like wading birds.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, there'd be so much material there for a choreographer to use and into a work. I mean, it's just a gold mine, I think.
Complete gold. Or Muppet Show. I don't know.
it's that thin edge we all work.
Uh-huh. Definitely.
That's pretty funny. I quite like the Muppet Show, actually.
I love the Muppet Show. That is not a slight in any way whatsoever.
Yeah.
Well, I'm that was pretty much most of my questions. Was there anything in particular that you've learned from these recordings, experiences, that you're most excited about?
I think I've probably mentioned most of it now, actually. Thinking it's just that, you know, the fact is it's an unending store of a material to inspire you. And everywhere I've looked in the universe, even like on the planet and off it, it's musical to actually a shocking degree. And one of the things I found recently is that I've got a piece next Thursday, a concert with Aspire group that we do. And I'm doing a piano piece, and I've got some recordings of the planet Jupiter and the Earth's atmosphere, and I've found the same notes in both Jupiter and the Earth's atmosphere, and I'm using that as that they're singing to each other, and so that's the kind of the basis of this piece of music, basically. So I'm just, like I said, to find actual clear cut notes in things like that is just completely shocking and amazing, really. So, like I said, everywhere I look, there's music.
And so have you ever considered yourself being a New Age musician?
perhaps I'm turning into one, actually. But actually, by default, I am. Honestly.
Yeah, I think so.
Because I've got literally the sounds of the planets. I mean, again, that's the other thing which is about that which amazes me. When you listen to these recordings, space, for example, it sounds like ancient Indian music, just notes and stuff. And it's again, I'm using an Indian drone in this piece of music now. And you just wonder, what did the ancients know? They all talked about the music of the spheres. Now we've actually recorded them in the 20th century, and it's musical. Yeah, absolutely. I've read a lot about quantum physics, like you do. If you look at quantum physics now, and again, this is something which has just blown my mind. Matter is really solid. It's just energy held in different vibratory states, basically. So vibratory states, frequencies, sound, it's all there. Everything in the universe is a different note or frequency. And each different molecule, each different type of atom has its own frequency or set of frequencies and everything. And that's what we're learning from quantum physics and everything. So again, that's just to bore you further about this.
No, I'm not bored at all, actually. You can't see me, but I'm not bored.
One of the things I've found out again, it's just blown me away, is that there's a professor of astronomy at Virginia University. He's analysed cosmic background radiation. Do you know, it's the fuzz we hear on, as you know, radios, and that's an echo of the Big Bang from when light formed, which was 400,000 years after the Big Bang. And if you use acoustical theory, he's analysed the Big Bang sound, because we've got these like satellite pictures of the cosmic background variations. And he's found that there's, like the Earth's atmosphere, there's a set of resonant frequencies in cosmic background radiation. And if you bring it up 50 octaves, it's a chord. So I now have the chord of the Big Bang, basically. I'm using
it. That's incredible.
Oh, no, it is totally.
That's incredible. That is mind-blowing.
So therefore, you can use acoustical physics to look back to the start of the universe. Now you know that there's a chord which was formed at 400 years after the Big Bang. You can use a different type of physics completely to look back in time. And I'm reading all this, I'm just thinking, my brain is not big enough.
That's incredible. So on day one, God produced a chord.
Yes, effectively, yeah. It's the day when he said, let there be light, which you
right.
See, because the early universe was a quantum flux, and then it cooled down enough that 400,000 years after the start of the universe for light to appear. So light must have appeared really quite suddenly. I'm finding so many links with nature and the universe and frequency and energy, and it's all completely connected. And we know from quantum physics that each, you know, particle in the universe is communicating with everything else in simultaneously. It's faster than the speed of light. And so this is the new things they're learning. So again, it shows you that the universe is, and we're proving this scientifically, is communicating with everything simultaneously.
You know, I was just thinking while you were talking that at least in organism studies, people look at, take recordings of a species and then take recordings of a similar species, and they use the wavelengths to
Absolutely,
differentiate
yeah.
one organism from another organism. and use this as a way of showing that this is a different kind of cricket than this kind of cricket. They're two different things. But I don't actually know of anybody who's recording the notes of nature as a means of recording and analyzing the world around. That there, people are taking the recordings themselves and they're looking at the waveforms.
Well, I suppose I do that because I'm a musician. That's what excites me. It's notes, yeah. And I suppose that's part of the shock. Everything's musical. Yep. What a shock.
Yep. You could publish that. It's totally a scientific paper.
You'd have to show me how to do that.
Really is. Yeah, you really could. I'd be glad to help. You could say, the paper could be something funny like where the A notes are.
Well, there's a start straight away.
Well, it was very good talking to you. And can you think of anything else that we missed?
Covered most of the ground. We've already covered most of the universe now, so.
Yeah, I know. From the Big Bang all the way to the modern times.